Hello and welcome to Hawkeye Nation. This is Hawkcast, your Iowa football, basketball, and recruiting podcast brought to you by GoIowaAwesomeAndRivals.com. I'm your recruiting analyst and host, Elliot Clough, at Elliot Clough on Twitter, joined by Adam Jacoby and Ross Binder on this Tuesday evening, post-Kirk Ferentz presser, post-women's win over West Virginia to send him to the Sweet 16, and post-NIT bowout by the men. We'll hit it all today on the podcast, but before we get started, make sure that you subscribe. If you are watching on YouTube, you hit that like button, drop a comment, let us know what you're thinking about all things Hawkeye sports right now. Of course, if you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you may be listening, hit that subscribe button, because you might be listening but you might not be subscribed as well. That way you don't miss a single episode of us. And of course, if you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, make sure you leave that rate and review. It helps us out a lot. We're going to start off talking a little bit about the men falling in the NIT. Not only that, but as of this afternoon, Tony Perkins has entered the portal, Iowa starting guard and second leading scorer at 14.6, I think, points per game this year, somewhere around then 14 point something. He 4.6 assists per game and 4.2 rebounds per game as well. One of the leading players on this roster in 2023, 2024, one of the better combo guards in the conference, at least when he's on anyway. And yet another blow to the backcourt of the Hawkeyes coming up next season, along with Desante Bowen hitting the portal. I don't think we have talked since then, but an unfortunate set of events for the Hawkeyes, a thinning backcourt that doesn't have any players coming in the 24 class other than walk-on Trayson Buchanan out of Indianapolis. It just got thinner. So it's not the end of the world. This team wasn't exactly going to be anything to ride home about going into next season, but losing one of your more productive players on the offensive side of the floor is not ideal, though he did struggle towards the end of the season. Adam, you were on your long ride home before you saw the news break. What'd you think about Perkins hitting the portal?
I was surprised, and not really in a good way either. There had been a few rumblings here and there about whether Perkins would be back or not. And he had a few options. And Fran even mentioned that in his statement that going pro was one of his options, returning or, entering the portal and finding somewhere else. But when you look back at Perkins' career at Iowa, obviously there's plenty of fans who, think that he left some untapped potential on the table. But he had been a bit of a project recruit from Fran McCaffrey. And when he came in, he didn't really have much of a jumper. Iowa was basically his only Big Ten offer. And Fran had even mentioned during a halftime interview, of all places, a conversation that he had with Perkins's high school coach. And one of the things that the coach told him was, look, if you put him on that flight to Iowa City, he's going to want to commit. So don't bring him in here to only bring him that far. And sure enough, Fran made sure that if Perkins was going to be on campus, that he was wanted there, that there was going to be an offer and it was going to be a committable offer. And the two stuck to that. Perkins got demonstrably better as a Hawkeye during his career, but he also didn't get good enough for a lot of fans, especially when it comes to consistency, especially when it comes to defense. He, had a very high opinion of himself, of his game, of his skills. And when you're that athletic for good reason, you should hold yourself in some high esteem at that point. But, we had talked to him during media day prior to the season, and he had mentioned that he wanted to be first team all defense in the Big Ten. Didn't really come to fruition. And a big part of that was consistency. What his game to game effort level was going to be on both ends of the floor. And that was always sort of the last step for him to climb as a Hawkeye. And it looks like he won't be doing that in Iowa City next year, wherever he's going to be playing. So that part is a little bit unfortunate, a little bit dispiriting for those of us who still believe in, things like loyalty, commitment, things like that. But at the same time, he's got to make the Tony Perkins decision. He's got to make the decision that's best for him long term, even if that's not going to be in Iowa City. It is a little bit disappointing to see that how tight both of those two were with each other over the course of that career, and to see Perkins's college career end somewhere else, presumably. A bit of a bummer. Ross, what did you think about this news when it came down? Were you surprised?
I don't think I was too surprised, and that was primarily because of, I think, the way Perkins just seemed in games, in media sessions, in just kind of in any sort of observable fashion over the last, 3, 4 weeks, maybe 2, 3 weeks. He had seemed just a little bit checked out, especially in games. I don't think that full effort and attention to detail, it would come and go, I think, from at times there'd be spurts where he'd be really locked in, really playing hard. And there'd be other times where didn't quite see that on offense or especially defense. And so it just did kind of seem like Tony, if he wasn't, really locked in here, then, it would be, see him moving on somewhere else. I don't know that I saw him entering the portal, because I mean he spent 4 years here at Iowa, but thanks to the magic of the COVID year, he does have one more year of eligibility to use, so he can go, somewhere else and make use of that. So given that, I could see why he would depart, why he would, want to maybe find something different. I find it bittersweet, honestly. I really enjoyed, I thought when Perkins was a recruit, there were some really exciting things about him. He had some phenomenal athleticism, and he could just really just jump out of the gym. And you wanted to see how he could develop that at Iowa. And I think that's kind of where the less sweet, I wouldn't say bitter, but the less sweet part of his game comes in, as parts of it developed, parts of it didn't. He was still breathtaking when he would attack the rim in transition. Like, he was phenomenal. But in the half court, if he's shooting jump shots, shooting three pointers, that was not the best part of his game, and it didn't get significantly better from when he started at Iowa to now. I guess we're at the end. There was improvement, but just, and the consistency there, like some games the jump would be working, sometimes it wouldn't. And so that was tough. Elliot, you were our beat writer covering him every game. So what'd you make of this news?
I wasn't exactly surprised either. I think this is a situation where he can go out and, I mean, like if we're talking about him potentially going pro, he can go through the draft or, yeah, the draft process, right? And Patrick McCaffrey said that he's planning on going pro. Tony Perkins can go pro if Patrick McCaffrey can go pro. Of course, there's always the option to go overseas. I don't see Tony Perkins being anything more than that in a G League player, at least right now. I mean, he could go out and surprise us. Of course, his athleticism has been referenced already. Not a consistent enough jump shot. The defense, he showed flashes. I'd be pretty surprised if he didn't lead the team in steals this year, but he's just that type of player, right? He goes after steals when he can, and to his benefit, sometimes to, well, not his benefit. And anyway, with all that said, he's still a damn good player, and he's a combo guard that can score. I think I said this on a must have been a radio appearance recently, but Tony's a guy that not a lot of teams have, but that a lot of teams could use. And so with 4 years of experience, being the second leading scorer, second team all conference by the coaches in the Big Ten, he's a guy that could go get a bag, go get an NIL bag, and play at a basketball school. He's from Indiana, right? I don't think he goes to Indiana. I don't think he goes to Purdue because he still has that chip on his shoulder. regarding them passing over him in his recruitment. At the end of the day, maybe he does. You know, I mean, his grandma did just pass away, right? Like being closer to home probably doesn't hurt. Additionally, he is a player that could actually go to a place like Kansas, like Duke, like UConn, Blue Bloods, and get time, maybe start, maybe fill what they need, and therefore get a ton of money. I really think that's probably a better situation for him than Iowa, than going pro, because he can still make a bunch of money, like I said, but he can also go like to the Big 12 and play in the best conference in the country, or the ACC, considering who's all in the tournament right now. But I don't see Iowa necessarily being the best option for him going into next season. I think he can play in front of a full arena, fill up his bank account, and get another year of play in probably a better conference that would help him develop and maybe develop in a different way, right? Like he's been in Iowa City for 4 years. He's learned under Sherman Dillard. He's learned under Fran McCaffrey. He's learned under Courtney Eldridge. But now he can go somewhere else that has maybe more routinely, sure, Iowa's made their NBA prospects, right? But maybe more routinely put out those type of prospects, like some of those blue bloods. So I think there's a place for him out there. Of course, I think it was the portal report. I'll lead the list of schools that have reached out since he entered the portal, because it's going to be a hell of a lot longer than this. I think they tweeted this out like an hour after the news broke that he entered the portal. That we confirmed with a source at iowa.rivals.com. But schools that have reached out to this point: Ole Miss, Arizona State, Arkansas, Mizzou, Oklahoma, Indiana, Nebraska, UCLA, Miami, BYU. Miami just in the Elite Eight. Did they make it to the Final Four last year?
Think
I
so.
know they made it to
It
the Elite Eight.
was a weird Final Four, to be sure. So, you know, no one would consider them, you know, a top four or top eight team last year. But getting that far is getting that far, and they want to go back. And, you know, if, coming from a school that hasn't made the second weekend of the tournament since 1999, the Clinton administration, it's you can see where that logic from Perkins came from. If making it deep into March is his goal, and that is the goal for most players, it's understandable. It's logical to look around Iowa City and say, that might not be happening here, at least while I'm here. It's understandable.
So, looking at this list, there are some suitors here that would make a lot of sense. Jim Larranaga, of course, the coach at Miami as well. UCLA, a ton of history there, though they've been down recently. Arkansas seems like they're interested in literally everybody in the portal. But with all of that said, I think Tony has some options out there that would probably be a better fit for him in his last year of college ball. And why not take advantage? You know, I don't blame him one iota. I think ultimately it's probably going to be best for him. For Iowa, they are wearing thin in the backcourt. You've got two scholarship guards on the roster now going into next season, which are Josh Dix and Brock Harding. Both very encouraging seasons. This last year, Josh Dix starting to look like he could be one of the better scorers in the Big Ten. Brock Harding will probably be a starting caliber guard here sooner rather than later. But you can't play them both 40 minutes a night, right? That's just not feasible. So, and well, additionally, they don't have a guard, like I said, coming in the 2024 class, a scholarship guard coming in the 2024 class. So we knew they were going to have to go portaling this offseason, but now they really have to hit the portal. They really have to hit the portal.
Yeah, the depth situation in the backcourt is something that really needs to be aggressively fixed, and not just in a get another freshman kind of way, or get a walk-on, or even, you know, get a kid who's going to give you 5, 10 minutes a game. Iowa needs ballers in the backcourt for 2024, 25, and beyond. Like, they need star caliber play from their guards. And if Brock Harding and Josh Dix are the only two guys that are going to be on scholarship next year, I mean, we're talking about Harding, who gets about 8, 10 minutes a game and still has some growth to get to that Big Ten level. Josh Dix made that leap himself, but in this current transfer portal era, NIL era, where you can just go wherever you want, Iowa needs to make sure that Dix is well taken care of enough to assure that he's going to come back too. It's an open question at this point. And without a sort of a framework for, how these commitments are going to work, how, whether you can or can enter, enter the portal, and whether or not there's going to be some eligibility penalty for that. Like, until that's all resolved, Josh Dix might just say, "Oh, by the way, USC is giving me $3 million. See you guys later." Yeah, and that's not a specific thing that I've heard or anything like that, but it's, for as much potential as he's flashed this season, this past season, and for his youth, and for a kid who, made the under 20 Team USA roster prior to this season,
No, he didn't.
his,
He went to their
well, sorry,
camp.
made the tryouts,
Okay.
made the tryout, didn't make the roster. Sorry.
Misinformation.
Oh, God.
Oh,
Demonetized. Like, no, he tried out, got that feedback from coaches, and it was a very formative experience for him when we talked to him at Media Day. That's a taste of the big time. And that is something that he can parlay into, interest from other big time programs. So all of that is still on the table in terms of where that backcourt situation is going to come from next year. And if Fran is not aggressive in getting backcourt talent in, if you're Josh Dix, do you look around and say, "Hey, like, I know I'm good enough to start on a 20-win team. And if that's not going to be here, make sure it's somewhere else." That's a situation that college sports are in, that Iowa basketball is in right now. It's you got to make sure everybody wants to come back. Everybody.
Now, for those who watched the final game of the NIT for Iowa, they fell to Utah in the second round, 91-82 in Salt Lake City. You could kind of get a sense that this was ultimately going to be Tony Perkins' plans. He didn't seem all that engaged. I think he finished 1 of 5 from the floor. He and Peyton Sanford combined to go 2 of 16, which that doesn't exactly reflect Peyton. Just a tough night shooting for him, but you could see it body language wise, in my opinion, on Tony. And the season came to a close, and if that was any indication as to what the 2023-2024 season was like, you'd think it would have turned out worse than it was. But there were moments, the stretches of games, they beat Michigan State, they beat Northwestern right on the road, but ultimately, it does come to an end in the NIT. And with the way this roster is currently constructed and what they're losing going into the offseason, I mean, I've kind of already said it, but, and we've already said it, they better be active in the portal. I mean, Ross, I don't know if you have any real strong takeaways from that NIT game or this season, but that's really where I've ended up right now is they've got a great 2024 recruiting class coming in, but the portal is where you're going to make your team going into next season.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The class they have is good. It's also small. It's two guys, and they're both, I believe, kind of front court players, or Tadra's more of a wing, or can play on the wing, whatever. But the backcourt is a big question mark. And I was losing, even before today. They lost Bowen. Cricky's gone. Patrick McCaffrey is done at Iowa. There's just a lot of. They need more guys in anyway, and now with Perkins leaving, that need is just exacerbated, especially because it's happening in an area where they don't have guys coming in already. There's no, like you said, there's no freshman guards coming in, and there's no one like on the roster that was hurt this year that's going to be back next year. It's Harding, it's Dix, and then it's walk-ons. So they have got to hit the portal. And you've mentioned this in your articles about this situation recently, and it's dead on, but they have to do better in the portal than they did last year when they were addressing front court depth problems and came away with Cricky and Evan, even is it Evan Bronze?
Evan. Yeah.
It's Evan.
It's
Yeah.
Evan. He just spells it weird then. All right.
Yep.
Fair.
He can't have him
Yeah,
right
so
now.
even Steven. Anyway, so yeah, that was their haul last year. The production from those two this year was, I think, not what fans were hoping to get when they came in last year. They gotta have, Adam said it, they gotta have some ballers. They gotta have some dudes. They need guys not just that are gonna eat up some minutes. So when Josh Hart, yeah, when Brock Harding, sorry, is on the bench and Josh Dix, I just combined them into one player. We're down to one guard now, guys. We're really
Oh,
in trouble. When Brock Harding and Josh Dix need a break, it's more than that. They need guys that can actually, push those guys for playing time and, give some really meaningful contributions here. And that's going to be interesting because the guys that can do that, there's going to be a lot of other teams after them too. It's not like Iowa is going to be shopping, the only one shopping in that particular marketplace. So that's going to be a very challenging, I think.
yes. And whether or not, of course, there's conversation constantly on Twitter regarding how much money the basketball team has in terms of what they get from Swarm and how they allocate it and all of that stuff. Of course, that'll come into it'll be a part of the equation here. So we'll see what they're able to get out of the portal. Of course, you can follow along with us on iwithoutrivals.com. For all of that inside information, go ahead and subscribe. We will be following the portal this entire off season, and you can, like I said, you can subscribe there. Bunch of information coming here sooner rather than later, I'm sure. But excuse me. All that said, is there even that much more to be said on the men's team? I don't think there's much more to hit other than that those two big things. Ross, did you have anything?
No, I mean, that's obviously the big news. I think this is just going to be a really just critically important, period in the transfer portal for Iowa. Like if they are not successful, this spring, it's going to set things up in a, put things in a really difficult position next winter for that team, I think. So yeah, what it's going to be really big, what the basketball program is able to do over the next, I don't know, 3, 4 weeks, whatever. Elliot, you got something? Nope. Nope. Adam, you got something?
Yeah, the one thing that I just wanted to say is there was a lot of fan backlash against the seniors this season. Tony and Patrick McCaffrey sort of got the brunt of that, and there's going to be a lot of fans who are happy that Tony Perkins will not be back next year. And on some level, I get that. At the same time, even if you want to be aspirational about where Iowa men's basketball's future is, Tony Perkins would have helped Iowa win more basketball games next year than if he's not going to be on the roster. He was a critically important contributor, and I get that he was not consistent enough at his job, one, to lead Iowa to the tournament, and two, to, sort of satisfy fans. But just because your best player is maybe not good enough, he is still a guy that Iowa is going to miss. He is still a guy who is going to help put wins on the scoreboard, or the, I guess you don't put wins on the scoreboard, who is going to put wins on in the correct column next year. And now Iowa's got to figure out how it's going to get that production, get that experience, get that familiarity with a motion offense. Those are tough things to replace, even if, the way he went about it was sort of not championship level. It was still helpful. It was still productive. So Fran's got a big, big hole to fix, even if fans are happy that it's going to be somebody else wearing that jersey. So just Like, fans, be careful what you wish for because it could get so much worse than 19 and 15 in an NIT bid. It could get so much worse.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, that's the one thing with Fran's program is that it's been a very developmental program since he's been here. It relies on guys staying for multiple years, developing, getting better, and then you really, reap the rewards when they're upperclassmen. And with Tony, you got some of that, not as much as people wanted. But, a fifth year Tony Perkins versus, a plug and play guy out of the portal, it's going to have to be a really good guy out of the portal, I think, to be able to duplicate or improve on what Tony likely would have given you as a fifth year guy. Because I was not had a ton of success with just, grabbing somebody out of the portal and then making an immediate impact. Kripke was up and down. Rabracha took a couple a year to get better.
I was just
It's
going to
not it's
ask
not a
you.
huge it's not a huge list either, frankly. So that doesn't help.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do you think Iowa's sort of been spoiled by the success that Rabracha had coming from, I believe it was North Dakota State, maybe it was North Dakota UND. But like he turned into an all conference, at the very least honorable mention by the end of his career. And I think that sort of set an expectation of where like a guy like Cricky would be coming in. And man, like, if that's sort of the limit for what Iowa's going to get from a big out of the portal, like, let's temper our expectations on that front too. Now, fortunately, guards are a little bit of a different animal than, 6'9", 6'10" guys in terms of how they can contribute right away and how they can sort of shape the flow of the game around their own skills. But yeah, it's going to be tough. And I'm sure Fran McCaffrey would love to just hit the like go get Michael Jordan 2.0 button. Right. But it's like you said, Ross, it's going to be an extremely competitive portal. It's going to be a situation where guys are going to look at Iowa and be like, all right, is that going to be my best bet in terms of postseason success? Are they my best suitor? And for where scouting is today, for where the portal is today, the guys that are going to get Iowa back to that 20 plus win mark, maybe even up to a 25 win mark, they're going to have a lot of competition in the transfer portal, and a lot of money is going to be thrown at those dudes. So either Iowa's going to be the beneficiary of a guy sort of getting passed over by everybody, or Fran's going to have to roll double sixes yet again in his recruiting. And we've seen him do it multiple times, but ooh, he's up against the wall on this one, isn't he?
What do we say every year around the NCAA tournament? Who wins games in the tournament? Guards. What is Fran not known for developing? Guards. Both of those things combined gonna make it real difficult to land somebody in the portal. Real difficult because those big schools, those big basketball schools are gonna be saying, guards win us games. And those NIL collectives are going to say, okay, here's $500,000. Go get them.
It's what
Probably
they
not going
did
to
with Joe
happen.
Chissant. And look who's in the tournament now. It's, Joey Toots. There are basketball factories, Elliot, like you said, that can look at a guy like Toussaint and say, we can win games with that guy. Whatever role he had at Iowa was clearly not the best fit. But just because somebody does not work out perfectly at Iowa does not mean that they can't be part of a tournament formula. So Iowa has to keep that in mind too, that man, if Joe Toussaint's getting six digits in the NIL transfer portal market, all right, then if Iowa's offering six digits, they better understand that they're going to be maybe getting a guy of Joe Toussaint caliber. And there were, again, plenty of fans who were happy to see Joey Toots leave Iowa City when he transferred out to West Virginia. And so far it's been, he went from Virginia to, or West Virginia to Texas Tech. So far, it's been working out kind of great for him. So, again, understand what the market is in that transfer portal. Understand that it's not like you can't just say, here's 25 cents, now go be a first team All Big Ten guy. Like, there is a correlation between how much Iowa spends on NIL and the talent coming in. That's just going to be the case going forward. And they have to address that in a really big way this offseason. Really big way. That's it.
So, on to the women, headed to the Sweet 16 once again after their victory over West Virginia last night. And boy, oh boy, has the Twitter response been something. I'm not going to delve into it unless you want to, Adam, because this is your beat, but I'm going to go right to you here. Initial thoughts after the win, during the game, like what were the big takeaways from this one?
Well, during the game, it was, well, one, the atmosphere was incredible, and it was yet another game at Carver Hawkeye Arena, the last game at Carver Hawkeye Arena for the seniors like Gabby Marshall, Kate Martin, and little known guard Caitlin Clark. And sure enough, the Hawkeye fans showed up, showed out, sustained noise over 100 decibels several times yet again. I mean, that hurts my ear. At one point, I had my earbuds in just like, so something could act like earplugs just for my own hearing's sake. So the atmosphere was incredible. It was a competitive game, just like everybody expected, up to and including the Iowa players in the scouting report. And there was a little bit of controversy about the officiating, especially in that fourth quarter when 14 of Iowa's 16 points came at the free throw line. At the same time, it's West Virginia and their press defense. Their entire game plan was to ugly it up, and it almost worked. And the only reason it didn't work is not because the officials were calling 27 fouls on West Virginia compared to 11 for Iowa, because that reflected both of their styles of play for the game. It was because West Virginia was not hitting jumpers, and that is not the officials' fault. I didn't see one referee block any of those three pointers that bounced off the iron. All right. It was Gabby Marshall, not a referee, who blocked that shot that led to Sitta Fulter's and one that ended up giving Iowa the lead that they didn't relinquish. Like, Iowa went out and won that game in a tough situation. The officiating, some of those were tough calls, but officiating is tough. Like this cannot be anybody's first experience with iffy refereeing in the women's game, especially. Like, men is barely better. But watching that game live, I didn't see a whole lot of calls that should have gone the other way, whether they were against Iowa, whether they were against West Virginia. Most of them looked about right. And there were several instances where I looked at the folks around me on press row and it was like, are they really not calling that? And it was West Virginia playing that physical defense. If anything, the referees could have called 40 plus fouls on West Virginia. That's the way they played, and it has worked out great for them. And again, the formula kind of almost worked against Iowa. They would have been glad to take that free throw disparity if it meant a win. They would have been over the moon about it, and that would have been the blueprint to beat Iowa. It still kind of is. So, what it comes down to is Iowa went out and won that game in a way that West Virginia didn't. And the people that sort of say, well, the refs stole it is a phrase that I saw on Twitter multiple times. And some of that is just sort of casual fans watching their first ever women's basketball game and thinking it's not fair. I don't like Caitlin Clark. Okay. Say that all you want. Like, Iowa's still advancing. And in a way, it's sort of a like a, all right, welcome to March. You can ugly the game up all you want. And you're not going to get the superstar calls. Like, even saying that to Iowa, like, Iowa is not going to get the superstar calls that like Caitlin Clark was getting for most of the regular season, even though they're Big Ten refs that were out there for that game. And so when it came down to that crunch time, when it came down to those last 5 minutes after West Virginia had tied the game back up after scoring the first 10 points of the fourth quarter, you can go ahead and point fingers at everybody else, but that was a 5 minute pressures on, like it turned into a 5 minute game. Iowa was the one that took control of that game from there. and not West Virginia. West Virginia played great. They deserved a whole lot better than an eight seed, and they deserved a whole lot of an easier second round opponent than the Hawkeyes. Bar none, flat out. Like, that's a good team. But Iowa earned it. West Virginia didn't. That's tough news to the Mountaineer fans. It's tough news to Cyclone fans who have had nothing, but Caitlin Clark to focus on since they lost to Stanford. Tough news for Nebraska fans who think that Caitlin Clark isn't the reason that Iowa's popular. But that's what it comes down to. Iowa, as a one seed on its home floor, said, "We're not going to lose this game. We've been in these tough situations before, many times," and they went ahead and won. What did you guys see on TV? Because, like, one, I didn't see any of the telecasts, and two, these are ESPN telecasts, and ESPN didn't really cover this team all year, and they like to sort of push the drama, for the casuals, and all that. How did ESPN treat this telecast, guys?
It was all about Iowa all the time. They did little briefs on Caitlin and Cade and Gabby and maybe some stuff on Lisa Bluter here, but they didn't exactly act like West Virginia was getting screwed over either. I think that was only Twitter. I mean, Ross, did you gather that? I didn't like the way Twitter reacted. I think is just a sort of. So let me illustrate this with a story. My sister is not into sports like at all. She messaged me this morning and said that she saw on Twitter or on some social media that Caitlin Clark is whiny or something like that. And my response was is that people like to hate greatness. People hated Michael Jordan. People hate LeBron James. People hated Tom Brady. Ask 12-year-old Elliot. I hated Tom Brady. The strong respect for him now because I'm a mature adult. And I think that's how the response should go with Caitlin. Sure, watching on TV, I mean, I've seen her live too. Sometimes it can be a bit much, but she's a superstar. She's supposed to get superstar calls, and she wasn't getting them. And I mean, I think their response largely is one, silly immaturity and hating greatness, and two, trolls. I really think it's that. Anyway, regarding the broadcast, I thought it was fairly well tempered. Obviously, they're going to focus on Iowa because they have literally the greatest women's basketball player ever. Like, can we be realistic about it? It's genuinely like silly to me. I was watching, and this conversation could take a whole new turn, but we'll revert back to this after what I say here. The conversation about Caitlin Clark not being a role model just is asinine. Asinine. You're telling players can't swear when they're on the basketball court? Oh my. Are you freaking kidding me? And I
It's similar.
said it much more graphically to the people in my personal life that were asking about it. Anyway, go ahead, Ross.
It's just the most bad faith argument. It's just ridiculous. It's I mean, I understand why people, interact with it to dunk on it because, oh, this is so stupid. But it's like it's giving oxygen to that is just so needless and so pointless because it's utter nonsense just perpetrated by trolls and idiots. And it's like and it's sexist too. I mean, she's doing the same thing that Jordan did, that Kobe did, but she has a ponytail and is a woman, so it's not acceptable the way it was for them. And that part of it is just ridiculous as well. But yeah, I mean, the idea of her not being a role model, I mean, try telling that to the 5,000 girls at that game last night, or the millions, literal millions tuning into that game. There was a report that came out this afternoon that that game, a Monday night second round game in the NCAA women's tournament, drew 4.9 million viewers, which is an astounding number for any tournament game, let alone, the second round game. Like, yeah, like I don't think that role model thing is is worth the time of day, honestly. And I regret talking about it as much as we have, Elliot.
I'm right there with you. Tell that to all the kids that she visited in the Stead Family Children's Hospital over her 4 years in Iowa City.
The thing about kids is they don't listen to any of these arguments. They don't care whether adults think that she's a role model or not. They don't care. And if they didn't think that Caitlin Clark was aspirational, they wouldn't be showing up. I guarantee you that. They would not be bothering their parents to go and see those games.
They don't care whether or not jackasses think she's a role model or not. Not adults.
No. And then to the point about her work in the referees, let's just zoom as far out as possible. Name me one star athlete who doesn't work the referees. Name one.
There is not one.
It is part of knowing the game, like having the game slowed down for you to that level, kind of like probably slowed down more for Caitlin Clark than for the referees themselves. So like, and I think that is a constant for these guys. And here's a perfect example of that. Tim Duncan is like, in terms of being even keeled, in terms of like borderline aloof as a guy on and off the court, soft spoken, worked the referees like crazy. And he's also a guy who, at least when he was playing, and this might still be the case, and I think that this is instructive. He set some sort of NBA record on a machine that tests your reflexes. It like a like I don't know what it's called. People can Google it and this and that. But he had world-class reflexes. And I think one, that helps him be a great player, but two, it also helps him understand, like, oh no, like I did get fouled, you know, like I got hit on my arm a tenth of a second before like I you know got the ball off or something like that. That level of reflexes is how the game has slowed down for him. And because he has a better understanding of like how basketball works, because the game is slower for him than it is for the referees, he will get on them for that because he knows it better than them. It's the same dynamic with Caitlin. You know, I don't know what her reflex machine test scores were or anything like that, but you know it's going to be good, one. And two, it evinces that same understanding of the game at that high level. And you just want to say, hey, look, I'm playing this game at a level that few have ever seen. The last thing I want is the referees to muck it up for me and all the, you know, fans and all the people watching. And so, yeah, it is a part of the game. It is a part of greatness. You better be right. Like, no one wants to see somebody working the referees when they're dead ass wrong 75% of the time. Like that's not fun. That's, you know, Draymond Green. But we're not talking about that with Caitlin. Like and I guarantee you, with the amount of attention that she gets on social media, on TikTok and this and that, if she were protesting incorrect calls with regularity, we would know it by now. That would be the whole discourse around her by now, is that she doesn't know the rules of the game if she were protesting for no reason. So yeah, I almost feel bad engaging it to this level because Ross, like you said, it's bad faith. By and large, it is bad faith. But we also do need to sort of acknowledge that women's basketball fandom is still in its infancy for so many people, especially Iowa fans. And so they are acclimating themselves with this game as we speak, and expect, you know, expecting them to understand that, oh, well, Caitlin's, you know, arguing with the referees because this is what all-star athletes do. You guys and I both know that, or all know that already. Maybe not everybody does. And so engaging or and so dismissing things without explaining why we're dismissing them to the most casual, to the most new fans of any age, almost does them a little bit of a disservice. So I just wanted to, you know, make sure that that understanding of what star athletes are all about, wanted to make sure that that was said. But yeah, with all that, in terms of giving any voice to any of these arguments in particular, that's not going to be a worthwhile use of time because, yeah, it's bad faith. It's people trolling for attention. Radio hosts, people who absolutely know better. And at some point, like, if the way that you want to get attention is to just mimic a shithead, there goes our demonetization again. And people can't tell the difference, then you're just being a shithead. And women's basketball doesn't really need more shitheads now, especially like volunteer bad faith. I'm just doing it for yucks. Like, take it somewhere else. Take it to the NBA. Like, this is a moment that really deserves good faith. So I hope we get more of that, he says as he's about to go log back onto Twitter. So that's that's the end of my rant.
So I think you alluded to it, Adam. What this does is what I guess what it shows is that the women's game is growing, right? That's the silver lining here. I mentioned jackasses and you mentioned shitheads. Well, they're jumping on board now. We had them all for football. And now that, that cynical BS is starting to come along with women's basketball. And it's because of the greatness of Caitlin Clark. And it's because of the greatness of players like Cameron Brink and Audie Crooks and Angel Reese that these folks have come out of the woodwork to watch women's basketball. And that's ultimately a good thing, right? Ultimately a good thing. The women's game is continuing to grow. It'll follow Caitlin Clark to the WNBA. It'll probably follow Addie Deal to Iowa and Callie Levin in the 24 class. I don't follow women's recruiting like Adam and Braden do for us at iowa.rivals.com, which you should follow along, of course. But it's going to continue to grow, and the skill set and the shooting and the scoring and the athleticism, we're going to continue to see it grow for women's basketball as well. They will take on Colorado in the Sweet 16 in Albany. Adam, you'll be there. I don't know how much you've looked into that Colorado matchup, but I think we talked about it right when the selection show, well, after the selection show happened on the podcast. Colorado was a team that looked like they could have been a one seed, and then they had injuries and kind of fell off. So is this another indication of Iowa having probably one of the toughest regionals in the country here?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like you mentioned, Colorado sort of tailed off at the end of the season, and so they slipped to a five seed. And there was one stretch where they played Oregon State at home. Oregon State was a three seed, and then three straight road games against Stanford, UCLA, and USC. Of course they lost all of them. But that is a murderous stretch of basketball. And if Iowa had come out of that, if this Iowa team had come out of that stretch at 2-2, they'd have been doing cartwheels. So, yeah, a bit of a tough stretch for the Buffaloes, but by and large, when you look at that team and look at a team that had been really trending as a one or a two seed going into that stretch of play. Oh, I'm sorry, it was a road game against Utah, not against Stanford. We'll make sure the record's corrected there. But Utah is another top 25 team. They were a high seed too. And they just sort of ran into a scheduling buzzsaw. And we're talking about a team that had started the season something close to like 20-1, was in that top five. I think they got as high as top two. Number two was cursed this year. So we understand that. It's not a situation where I was going up against a team that doesn't have the juice. Like, this isn't a mid-major makes good sort of situation. Like gets by with a easy schedule, but yeah, by and large, Colorado's defense is difficult. Their size is going to cause a problem, or it's going to cause problems for the Hawkeyes. And they don't play like West Virginia. They're not going to, like, they force 10 steals a game. They do play defense, but it's not going to be the, like, beat the hell out of me sort of situation. So it's going to be a tough matchup. Absolutely. Iowa's going to be happy that it is on a, I mean, and they're not going to be happy that it's away from Iowa City, but they're going to be happy that it's not in Boulder, that it's going to be in a neutral site and technically closer to Iowa City than Colorado in Albany. So it's still going to be a friendlier crowd. But yeah, Colorado's going to pose a tough test, especially if they're playing like the Colorado of, January, December, that first half of the season. Ross, what have you sort of seen about the Buffaloes so far? Were you able to watch any of the Colorado KSU game this weekend?
I did, and I think there was a stretch in that game where both teams were unable to score for several minutes, which was not good. But they are overall a very good team, obviously. Deserving of their five seed, possibly deserving of more. But as you mentioned, they had that skid towards the end of the season that definitely hurt them in terms of the seeding. But I mean, the top half of the Pac-12 this year was just absolutely loaded. Stanford, UCLA, USC, Colorado, Utah. They were a four seed or five seed. They lost to Gonzaga last night, I believe. Just a lot of really good teams. And, I think emerging from that gauntlet was not easy. And the Buffaloes, did a fair, a great job from, what they're able to do. I am interested in it from a matchup standpoint. I think you mentioned the size, and that's something Iowa didn't have to contend with West Virginia. They were not a big team, but Colorado's got some posts that Iowa, how they match up with them will be a very interesting subplot in that game, I think. The West Virginia game, we saw a lot of Hannah Stuhlke, and she got the crap beat out of her by West Virginia, and she came through though with double double, some big free throws at the end of the game. Just really hung in there and showed a lot of toughness in that game. But this might be a game where you need a little bit more Addison O'Grady and Sharon Goodman or AJ Ettinger. You just might need some more actual size, to just kind of match up with what the Buffaloes are doing down low. What do you make of that matchup?
So the one thing that I noticed from that KSU game, the Wildcats had Ayoka Lee in the middle, and there's a stretch like pretty close to the beginning of the game. Charlotte Whitaker, who's one of the bigs that the Buffaloes had, she was in there for about like a minute or two, and immediately just picked up two fouls. She doesn't even start. Like we're talking about a backup here, but she's a bigger body. Let's see, she's listed at 6'3" and not small, and she just basically just went out there and tackled Lee. And they've also got Vonley on the center, Quay Miller, a bigger forward, and they play tough physical defense. Ross, I think you're right. This is going to be a situation where, like, I think Addie O'Grady's going to have to be at least a 15-minute, maybe even a 20-minute player, especially if Colorado's going big enough on that interior that maybe it makes sense for Iowa to have two bigs on the floor, sort of move Stuhlke back to the four. We haven't seen Bluter want to do that very often, especially after the first few games of the season. When they finally settled into that rotation. But when you look at, who they have on the floor and, those bigger lineups for the Buffaloes, it might be a situation where you do want to go super big lineup, which we've rarely seen from Iowa this year, but we have seen in very limited instances. So that's something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on. Whether or not Colorado's hitting their jump shots, Ross, like you mentioned, those cold stretches are brutal basketball to watch, and Colorado has been sort of susceptible to them for from time to time this season. Does Iowa get Colorado, or are the Buffaloes going to heat up a little bit on the wings? Buffalo hot wings. Yeah, pretend I meant to do that. Ross has logged off the call. Elliot, anything that you've sort of noticed about this sort of situation, or have you just sort of been underwater with men's basketball and football?
Underwater, baby.
Yeah.
And all the recruiting coverage, i.e. recruiting analyst and host, with spring ball. No, I watch the women when they play, and I talk about it with you guys. That's all I got, guys.
Well, what do you want to see? Okay, so what do you want to see Iowa do better against Colorado that you thought they could have improved on against West Virginia?
Gabby Marshall and Kate Martin hitting shots, getting involved. There, I tweeted about it, and not a whole lot of people engaged with it. I think it was because it was late in the game, but Gabby, I felt like got into the paint pretty frequently, but it didn't result in a shot by her, like a floater or just a little middie. I think that she was hesitant for whatever reason in that game. She finished with 0 points. Kate Martin, I thought there were a couple times where she passed up some open shots too, and it was said on the broadcast, and I wholeheartedly agree, is if it's just Caitlin versus everybody else, and I'm paraphrasing here, then they're probably going to lose, especially against some of these elite teams, because you can, like, number one, basketball 101 is you cannot ball watch. You cannot just stand around and watch the ball, and that's what they did a little bit against this West Virginia team. They run into a physical team like that with a lot more talent that's going to hit some shots. They could have lost that game by 20 against a really good basketball team. Like, if we're being honest, someone that has a wing that doesn't shoot the ball from the right side of her head and just launch it. That took me off guard when I was watching. I couldn't tell you who's what the player's name was, but that's a situation that needs to be rectified in this next game in terms of Gabby and Kate's involvement. Molly Davis coming back would obviously be massive, and it would have been massive last night in terms of having another ball handler.
What
I want to
have you,
see
yeah.
more from Kylie Fierbach, and Sydney rose to the occasion, but she's another player that you can get her involved. Your offense is going to be better. And Hannah just kind of looked off last night. I think 10 points, 10 rebounds is what she finished with, something like that.
It
But
was a double-double, but yeah, she was battling,
She
yeah.
could have she missed a few layups. She could have finished probably with 20 and 10. But yes, battling. Some folks, again, make it brief, posted a video of her going back and forth with what's her name that she was matched up with from West Virginia, the center, where they got locked and were like, I don't know how this is a foul on West Virginia. Meanwhile, Hannah hit her face on the ground. So that's just to illustrate the matchup last night. That's pretty much my main takeaway. Caitlin was Caitlin, of course, and they've gotta have more from the supporting cast. That's it, against Colorado on Saturday.
Yeah, I would agree. And watching that game, that was just one of the strangest, I think, wins for Iowa because four players scored all of the points. Like, that's weird. They got 0 bench points. They got 0 points out of Marsh Gabby. They got not that many out of Kate Martin. I mean, the normal supporting cast did not show up on the scoreboard in that game. And that's why a big part of why it was such a grind to try and get that win was because Caitlin had half the points, and then it was Kate Martin, Stolke, and Anna Folter, the other three players that they were the only three that scored points. I guess they had the other 32. That was just a very bizarre way to win a game, and it's not something that seems that I would be able to duplicate. I should not use that as a formula for any games going forward, I would say, nor would they want to. But they have to have that help from the supporting cast. They need other players to hit shots. That was the other thing. Kaylin was the only player that hit a three-pointer last night. And the only other game where that was the case, I believe Adam had this in his recap, was the first K-State game this year, and Iowa lost that game. Like, Iowa needs other players to hit shots and help out on offense, as otherworldly as Caitlin is. She cannot do it by herself.
It's funny that you should mention all of that, Ross, because I got an opportunity to ask Jan Jensen about that after the game, basically that exact question. It was, West Virginia got what they wanted out of Iowa's production. That was their blueprint. They got it. Iowa had 7 assists as a team on like 16 or 17 made shots. 7 as a team. Caitlin usually gets more than that by herself. Tied her season low for assists, and this was in my recap too. And again, that season low came in that loss to K-State too. West Virginia had their whole blueprint, and it came from Manhattan, Kansas. And again, if they hit their jumpers, Iowa's out. And South Carolina is more capable of hitting jumpers than, say, West Virginia is. And South Carolina is also capable of playing that kind of defense too. So, I mean, Iowa really cannot afford to play like that if it makes it to places like, I don't know, Cleveland for the Final Four. But going back to the point, so I asked Jan, like, are you thinking we've got a lot to improve? Are you happy? And she basically said, like, I'm 0%. We have a lot to improve at this moment. Like, they're going to go back, they're going to try to fix things. But by and large, they look at the fact that they just took on West Virginia, got West Virginia's best game, like one of the best defenses in the nation, only turned the ball over 15 times, which, sounds tough, but you got to remember West Virginia forces like 24 a game. And so, yeah, I'm disappointed at the moment at some of it, but I'll take 15 turnovers against them. I'm more thrilled, and especially in this, everyone's like just survive in advance and worry about it later. I'm pretty sure Colorado doesn't press like that, but I'm not. I'm just watching them, is what she said. So they're over the moon with how that game went, even though like formulaically it was not Iowa basketball. All they wanted was the win, and that's what they got. And now they're on to these neutral courts. They don't have the, like, oh my God, we have to win at home pressure anymore. It's going to be a different pressure, but they don't have to like worry about sending fans or like Carver fans home empty. They don't have to worry about a disaster anymore. Fans still want them to go to the Final Four. Fans are still going to be upset if they like only, air quotes here, only make the Sweet 16 or only make the Elite Eight, but all they wanted was the dub. And that's what they got. And they will not harbor any of this. Well, what if we blah blah blah? That's not the way they're thinking in that locker room. So that's what they're taking to Albany, is just a like, all right, next one up. And it really is that simple to them, or at the very least, that's what they're telling me, is that simple.
All right. You who they think you get, or who do you guys think they're going to play in the Elite Eight, assuming they beat Colorado, LSU or UCLA?
Ooh, probably UCLA, but we've seen LSU just get kissed on the forehead time and time again. We've seen Kim Mulkey get kissed on the forehead time and time again. And if she wants to rally, Adam, don't even go
I mean, if
there. Go
I
ahead.
would say UCLA also, but if LSU plays the way they did in the second half of that Middle Tennessee game, their second round opponent, they're going to be tough to beat because they absolutely took Middle Tennessee to the woodshed in that half and just dominated them to a astounding degree. And they're Middle Tennessee, UCLA, not quite the same thing. So they're going to have, a significant challenge against the Bruins. But that LSU team was the first glimpse, when I've seen them this year, when they looked like, oh yeah, that was the team that won the national title last year. They're still pretty darn good. Elliot, you got something.
Ross, your mic, it just went crazy that entire answer. Just like fuzzy. So maybe unplug and plug it back in while we're talking here.
It was
But
just for that one. That was the only one that had happened on.
yes. Are you in agreement with everything he said there, Adam?
Yeah, for the most part, it's a situation where we've seen what LSU can do. They know, like, Iowa likes to talk about their experience from years past LSU now has the experience of winning the national championship, of being on that highest level and, playing out of their minds, banking in three pointers. It was flukish what they did to Iowa, but it still happened, and they still have that data, that muscle memory. So, I don't want to see Iowa versus LSU. I'm sure the networks do because it would pop a rating that women's basketball has probably never seen before. I can see why ESPN wants it. I can see why these storylines exist. I don't want to cover that game. I don't want that headache again because so much of it is not about basketball. Iowa UCLA, one, would be better basketball, and two, it would be so free of the BS. At the very least, it would like the foreseeable BS, the BS that we can see coming. So I would like to see that. And I think UCLA is just better. Like Lauren Betts is a menace on the interior. And they just have ballers down there. And UCLA has proven it against a tough conference all year. So if that matters, then I think it's going to be UCLA. I think it's going to be by double digits. But Iowa does also have to get by Colorado first, and that's not a sure thing. So my guess is it's Iowa UCLA. And that will be real difficult because UCLA can use its size to its advantage too, and has had a bunch of experience doing it in that like very taller Pac-12 that they've got going on. So if I had to guess, that's it. Elliot, what do you think?
Sure.
All right.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, guys.
Yeah.
I can
Well,
tell you all.
what do you want?
Who do I want?
Yeah,
Oh,
who would you rather see? Would you rather see Iowa LSU 2.0
well,
or a new opponent?
I've never seen UCLA play. Obviously, I kind of do want to see LSU Iowa 2.0 because yes, like last year's national championship was such a fluke. In so many ways, officiating was god awful, god awful. And of course, those shots going in for LSU. They've got so much talent on that team, but they've had their issues. So, yeah, I don't really have a stake in the game, I guess. But if either way, whatever happens, I'll be watching. I can tell you that. I was going to say, I can tell you all about Iowa's 2020, or excuse me, 2025 perspective recruiting class for football, but ask me about UCLA and LSU women's basketball or men's basketball for that matter, and I'm not going to be able to give you a great answer. But which, by the way, for you, those recruiting folks out there who do pay attention and might be out of the loop on Twitter, Zay Robinson just committed to Iowa State about 10 minutes ago. So, wide receiver from West Des Moines Valley, one of the more coveted players in the state, has had some injury history, but he is a stud, and as long as he can stay healthy, the Iowa State will be really, really happy with him. But
Nice kid, too.
yeah, oh yeah, Zay's a great kid. But speaking of football, let's move on here to the press conference from today. Kirk Ferentz talks with the media prior to the schedule for us for spring ball. And we got to learn a little bit about Tim Lester, about the Caden Proctor situation, and some more. Adam, of course, going to be writing about Caden Proctor and what we learned there. My piece from today's presser was about Tim Lester and how things are going for the offense, along with the quarterbacks, who is going to head the ship there for Iowa on the field. And we do have some inside intel on how things are going in practice, which you can check out at iowa.rivals.com/subscribe if you're not a subscriber yet. Shared that on Twitter the other day, but all the details are there on our premium board at iowa.rivals.com. Now, for me, the number one takeaway was that quote from KF today about Tim Lester and how things are going in terms of installing the offense. And I'll read it to you verbatim. Basically, we're just taking his playbook material and going with it. And if that isn't encouraging, I don't know what is. Of course, I think a lot of folks fall into the boat of let me see it before I believe in it. But a lot of things that I've heard line up with that. And to hear that out of Kirk Ferentz's mouth, which of course you can not always guarantee it's gonna be something that you can take to the bank that you can expect to see on the field from Kirk in a press conference, but that's encouraging. Ross, what do you think in that department as someone who read my article, edited my article?
Yeah, no, I agree. Do I sound okay? I hope.
Yes. I was just about to slide back. Yeah, go ahead.
I thought it was encouraging, and it was, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding comes in Martin the fall. So until then, all we can go on is, their public statements. But this is exactly what you were hoping to hear Kirk Ferentz say about Tim Lester and, the rebuilt Iowa offense is, if it's not Tim Lester being given, the full control of the keys to the car, it sounds like he's got a lot of control. And I think that's what people are hoping and wanting to see is an offense that doesn't, look like, the same old Iowa offense, and that doesn't look like what Kirk Ferentz has been, pushing for the last, 2 decades. So if Tim Lester is able to modernize that offense and, change it and, bring some new ideas into the locker room and into the playbook, that's a tremendously exciting thing. Because obviously anyone who watched Iowa the last couple of years knows those new ideas are much, much needed. So I think based on, what you got out of Kirk today about Lester, it's incredibly encouraging. Now, again, it's words. It's March, almost April, I guess, still March, and we're not going to know for sure until that team takes the field in September exactly what this, new Iowa offense looks like, what it can do. But for where we're at right now, I was pleased with what we heard. I thought it was exactly what you wanted to hear at this point in time. Adam, did you see things any differently?
Yeah, I more or less I'm in the same boat as you, and a sort of a common response has been, well, let's see what it looks like in September. Well, all right, but we can't really speed up the calendar any. So on some level, the folks who say, well, let me see it in September. All right, go ahead and hibernate through the summer. In terms of what we're able to see here, there was one little bit out of Kirk that sort of caught my ear, and he was talking about the process of installing Lester's offense, the sort of RPO situation, which has not really been in, I was going to say this metaphorically, but it's pretty clearly literally true, because I was going to say it's not been in their metaphorical vocabulary. But one thing that he said was, and I'll read off of the quotes here, it's been a process, though. We're trying to install something each and every day. It's been challenging, I think, for everybody, and myself included, just learning the language and all that type of thing and trying to keep up. We're doing that and seeing how the install is going in, then also see how the players are handling all that and where it all ends up. We'll see at the end of spring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, that part is true. But let's remember, Kirk Ferentz is not particularly up on RPOs and the intricacies of them. Traditionally, he's learning, but this is going to be an adjustment for him too, for the head coach. And so, yeah, you kind of wanted him to be up on this 15 years ago, right? Like, but it's the apocryphal Chinese proverb. It's not actually a Chinese proverb, but people like to say it is. But the fake Chinese proverb is the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The next best time is now. Kirk Ferentz is planting that RPO tree now. All right. He chose the next best time to do it. So we do have to understand that this is going to be an installation process. And hopefully it's not going to be the same sort of 18-month, learn a brand new language sort of situation that was going on with Brian Ferentz's playbook. And by all indications, that is not going to be the case. And I think Iowa understands, especially after the success of, guys like, I don't know, Michael Penix Jr., that you do want guys to be able to walk on the campus, read your playbook, and go contribute year one. And for so long, we had heard that that's not the way that things operate in Iowa City. Well, those days are over. And so it's sort of a brand new era again. And Kirk's had a few of these now. And he has been, for as stodgy as he is, for as lower C conservative as he is, just in terms of what goes on the football field. We're not talking politics, but like in terms of that, like practical to a fault, Kirk Ferentz, he has been a little bit more able to change with the changing tides of college sports than, let's just throw out a different name here, Fran McCaffrey. Kirk 5.0 or whatever version of Kirk this is, the RPO Kirk. You know, there was transfer portal Kirk, there was new like riverboat Kirk. Like there's so many different Kirks that have happened. He does at the very least understand that his ability to stay an effective college football coach means that 20th century offensive concepts are just not going to cut it anymore. And he's never going to come right out and say those words in that order, especially to, you know, jagoffs like us sitting there with our, you know, phones and earning 1% of his salary. But, you know, this is the sort of the way that he cops to that publicly. This is the Kirk Ferentz way of saying, yeah, that's what we're doing. So Iowa fans should be encouraged. They should not think that this is going to be a one-day install that's going to work perfectly, because that's not the way any playbook works in football. And that's not a Kirk Ferentz, you know, reflection. That is a college football reaction or a reflection. But they understand the task in front of them. They understand that trying to squeak out wins when you'd score 14 points is not sustainable, and it's not the way that you get to championship football, which remains their goal. Elliot, I did ask Kirk about the quarterbacks and what their sort of development goals were. Did not really get a substantive answer, but it is a situation where the quarterbacks sort of have to be involved in that transition, and they're learning along with Kirk, and that too is going to be a process, especially with Cade McNamara hurt again, injured, you know, like recovering from surgery again. So that will throw its own wrinkles into this, but what did you think about one, his comments, especially in terms of the install process, and two, sort of what it means for the team?
Well, in terms of the install process, regarding what you just said a moment ago about scoring 14 points and kind of hoping to win, we did get the complimentary football quote during
Oh,
today's presser.
that's never going away.
I will say, he said in regards to Tim and how things are meshing, he said, I think it's going to look different regarding the offense, but I think philosophically we're in line. Not that it was a prerequisite, but he has been a head coach, and I think he understands how all three things function together. We played good defense here pretty much 20 plus years. That was a building block coming in. That's been a big part of the blueprint, I guess. Stats are great and all that, but the most important stat is winning games, and that has been first and foremost. My visits with Tim, I think that's where he's at too. He thinks the same way, and he gets it, and he gets how things work together. So that gave me a little bit of pause, but all in all, to hear that they are installing his playbook, to hear some of the things that we've heard that you can read about on the premium board is encouraging. I as optimistic as I can be, while also tampering expectations, is kind of where I'm currently at. Because I mean, I'll say it again. I'll believe it when I see it. September comes around and they're playing an actual Power Five football team, and we'll see if it comes to fruition.
There you
Regarding
go. They
personnel.
have a doozy of a September too. It, like the and of course I
Illinois
don't have the
State, Troy. I think they play Western Michigan again.
There's Iowa State and I
Iowa
think
State.
their last September game is that the Ohio State trip?
I
Or is
don't.
that prior to the bye week?
I think that's prior to the bye week. I'm pulling it up
Or
right
after the bye week.
now. Or, yeah, right, like what you said. Yeah, like I the four teams that I ref. Oh, sorry. They play Illinois State, Iowa State, Troy, and Minnesota. So they
Minnesota.
do
Yeah,
not
okay.
play Western Michigan again. I was wrong. But and that's at Minnesota. And then they're
Yeah.
at Ohio State. So
And the Ohio State trip is in October. That's after the bye week, correct?
yes, that's after
Yeah,
the
that's right.
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I got it. I got it.
So, the thing that I think ultimately concerns me and that you alluded to is the quarterback situation and the personnel, because you can bring in a great coach, but if the personnel is not up to par, if things don't click, if things don't mesh, then there's only so much Tim Lester can do in his first year, especially after taking over of what was a dumpster fire of an offense and getting rid of some bad habits, whatever that might be. I don't know anything necessarily specifically, but translating to the new is going to be difficult one way or another. I'm sure they're all saying thank God for the spring right now with Tim Lester taking over and things changing there. Do we want to hit on Caden Proctor and then get out of here?
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
Russ, you good with that?
We got a thumbs up from us. Okay. We are go. What was I saying? Kirk. So Kirk never said Caden's name once. He did the whole he who will not be named sort of situation. And it was basically he's not here. He doesn't want to be here. If he doesn't want to be here, we don't want him here. That's best for both parties. Wish him the best. See you later. Honestly, I don't think there's that much that we really need to cover here on the podcast. I think that can be really wrapped up well with Adam, but Ross, in knowing that, in seeing the transcript, do you think there was anything else to really glean from that? I think we got low key petty Kirk because he knows any saying anything particularly negative about a 19-year-old or 20-year-old isn't going to look good for him. But he also didn't say his name one time. And that might be just an NCAA issue, considering he's going to be in the portal here soon, though he technically isn't on Iowa's roster. And it's just a weird situation.
Yeah, I mean that even came up during the presser. Was like, where is Caden anyway? Like, is he in Iowa City? Is he still taking classes? And Ferentz is like, I don't know, and it kind of like, I don't care. He's not part of our programs, so it's kind of not my problem. Was kind of his attitude, it seemed like to me. Yeah, I mean, I think there was probably a little bit of pettiness there, but I think he's also like, I think this is the perspective that comes with coaching for 25 plus years is you've seen a lot, and dealing with 18, 19, 20 year olds for that long is you've seen a lot of guys do a lot of dumb stuff or change their minds and do whatever. So I think it takes a lot to surprise Kirk at this stage of the game, and I think he's got to be disappointed, obviously, and he's not going to express that publicly because, I mean, getting Proctor back was a tremendous coup for Iowa, and it was addressing an enormous need for that team heading into next fall, which is now not addressed. I mean, that came up during the presser too, is, hey, how's the offensive line look? And nothing substantive there other than the fact that Logan Jones isn't practicing during spring because of a off-season surgery. So, I mean, not a great sign either that one of your best guys on that unit is out for spring, and hopefully you want him to get fixed up and better for fall, but you also want him getting those reps in the spring and learning the playbook with Tim Lester too. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just a situation where whatever disappointment or he has is definitely going to be kept private. He's not going to show it publicly. I was more interested in his comments about NIL and the portal. And I'm interested, and I think you're going to write about this, Adam, but
I am.
there's
Spoiler alert.
some spoiler. I think there's some resignation to like, hey, this is just the way things are. And he says, I accept it. Privately, I wonder how he really feels about it, but publicly he's gonna, say, yes, I accept it. But yeah, what did you make of that, Adam? I guess I'll get a preview of your article.
The thing that sort of jumped out to me, and it sort of mirrored what we had written after the news came out in the first place, was this happened because it could. Like Kirk said, there's no structure, there's no framework, and it makes it interesting in that I don't know if it's sustainable. We're gonna have to be able to have a framework and a mode of operation. It's just part of the business, I guess. Unfortunately, we haven't experienced too many of those things. But like at some point, unless college football and especially the biggest sort of name programs out there, I mean, Alabama's happy about this, clearly, but I guarantee they don't want it happening to them. I guarantee they don't want, next player, 2.0 to come in and say, oh yeah, I'm actually going to go to Georgia. No, psych, I'm going back to Bama. No, psych, I'm going to Georgia. Like, if that happened and it was strictly contained in the SEC, there would be a rule banning it tomorrow. So there does, and Kirk mentioned that this is a lawyer situation at this point. And yeah, there's something to that because one, there's already lawsuits that sort of allowed Proctor to be able to transfer and play right away to begin with. But really, what that means is this now, with all this money that's being thrown around, Elliot is
Not
yes,
just
sir.
transfer, but transfer twice
Yes.
in one
Yep.
spring.
And still be able to play right away.
Yes.
And yeah. And so that's a situation where it's one thing for the NCAA to say, well, that's not allowed anymore. Yeah, sorry, there were lawsuits. So yes, it is. So this is a situation where the lawyers need to get together, and these are dirty words to college administrators, and have been for decades, have been for as long as the term student athlete was invented, which happened because TCU didn't want to pay for the medical care for a kid who got paralyzed on the field after he was done being a college student. Look that one up. If they really want to keep this from happening over and over again, it's going to have to involve collective bargaining. It's going to have to involve contracts. And it's probably going to have to involve referring to these guys as employees, which they are, because they're doing this on behalf of the university. They're wearing the right clothes as agents of the university, right? They're wearing Nike and they can't rep Adidas if they want to. And they're not doing it for college credit, are they? It would be cool if football were a major. It would be, I think, intellectually honest. But since they're not, and since this is quite clearly labor that they're performing on behalf of the university for the benefit of the university, and maybe, they'll get a few pennies here and there, but by and large, like, the university isn't sharing that money. That is an employer-employee relationship. And the NCAA has gotten around it by calling them student athletes for decades. That house of cards is falling in front of our eyes as we speak, and has been for the last few years. The sport just needs to get honest with itself. And college administrators have fought against it for decades, and I don't think it's a winnable fight anymore. They've got to approach it in good faith. They got to understand that collective bargaining, both of those words are important, and that the players are not going to get everything they want. In fact, what comes out of collective bargaining is probably, if that were to happen in college sports, what comes out of it will probably be more restrictive than what college sports is now. And that will be better not only for the programs, but for the players themselves, because it would allow them some stability that is currently not even enforceable. And without any enforceable rules, you don't have a structure. You don't have a framework. You are going to keep getting Caden Proctor situations happening, not only at Iowa, but anywhere in college football, anywhere where there's money being thrown around. And again, kudos to the Swarm for making sure that Caden Proctor did not get a whole lot of that money that was promised to him. when he came to Iowa. And they'll also say he wasn't promised any money to come, but he only got a little bit of money out of that car dealership, didn't get any of the Swarm collective money, didn't get the fans' money. So kudos to them for that. But this is just gonna keep happening until there's a more permanent solution. Kirk Ferentz is acutely aware of that based on his comments. And I don't really know of a football coach, a D1 Power 5 head coach at this point, who doesn't think that way. Guys, either of you guys sort of disagree with that? Any different reads of the situation?
We could talk about this stuff for hours.
Yeah.
We kind of already have. I mean, you
I
go
was
back.
gonna say, like, no one's gonna stick around for it, but we could do it.
Right. So yeah, on that note, I'm good to wrap it up here. Ross, did you feel like you needed to add anything?
Nope, I think we've discussed all of this stuff tonight for just about the right, way too long. So yeah, we're good.
And you're getting staticky right now as well. So perfect time.
Well,
Well,
even
it's
your
time to
mic
quit.
has given up on tonight.
The mic has said call it quits. So we will wrap it up here on this episode of Hawkcast. We appreciate you tuning in. Of course, do not forget to head over to iowa.rivals.com/subscribe to get all of our premium content that's following the transfer portal, that's following spring recruiting, that's following women's basketball, and of course, everything to come with spring football as well. Definitely want to stay tuned for that. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Drop a like, drop a comment. Let us know what you're thinking about women's basketball. All those dinguses that had something to say after this last game. The men and who they should go after in the portal. A guard, a center, somebody else. Who should they get? How are they going to get them? And then, of course, all things Iowa football. We want to hear from you down in those comments. And wherever you are listening, please hit that subscribe button. Don't miss an episode here of Hawkcast, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you are. Leave that rate and review. It helps us out a bunch. We really appreciate it. And I think that's it after this 34-hour-long podcast. We appreciate you tuning in. I am Elliot Clough at Elliot Clough on Twitter, joined by publisher Adam Jacoby and managing editor of the site at iowa.rivals.com, Ross Binder. And for now, we will see you next time.